Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. It's been almost 6 months since thousands of federal workers were fired and others were ordered to return to office. We'll hear from one VA employee in Cheyenne about that transition.
When you RTO people and you put obstacles in their way, they have to make choices.
A group of non-federal workers are helping fill in gaps on the Bridger-Teton National Forest after trail crews were cut earlier this year.
A project in every district isn't enough, but yeah, it's a start.
A university graduate says she's leaving Wyoming, citing a wave of new legislation targeting transgender people. Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Want to do more than just listen to Wyoming Public Radio? You can help us through our new volunteer platform. We're looking for a few folks to pick up court documents, take photos, and promote local events. Sign up with the volunteer button at the top of our website. We depend on you as much as you rely on us.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. It's been nearly 6 months since the Trump administration started firing thousands of federal workers and ordering others back to the office in its efforts to cut spending. We thought it might be a good time to get back in touch with some of the folks here in Wyoming who were affected. What we learned is that the firings have had ripple effects through people's lives, on workplace culture, housing, commutes, and even mental health. We start with a Veterans Affairs employee. Back in April, we heard from a nurse at the Cheyenne VA named Brigitte Paul. She helps coordinate home health care and was concerned about how upcoming return to office orders, or RTO, would impact her job. In the spring, the Department of Veteran Affairs also had plans to cut about 15% of its workforce, roughly 80,000 people. The agency has since paused that large-scale reduction in force, saying it's cut enough people because of normal attrition, early retirements, deferred resignations, and the federal hiring freeze. But Paul says the agency's return to office mandate this spring has led some of her colleagues to quit. She's back in the office now.
What I share with you is my personal experience and my opinion, and not the opinion of VA National. I'm not a spokesperson for the VA. I'm just a person working to take care of veterans, and this is my experience. I went from, in January, absolutely loving my job, to continuing to reframe my life, to remind myself that this is a job, and my priority is me and my family. And if I have to make a decision, I will choose my family and me. And I didn't ever feel like that. I was able to just move right back onto station, and I have a 10-minute commute. But there were people on our team of 10 that would have immediately had a 90-minute one-way commute. That was never what we were ever told would be happening as we took these remote positions. Before, there was kind of a workflow to what I did because I was alone and I could, you know, assess what needed to be addressed primarily and then address it without losing track or losing my place. And now I have to be very diligent before I leave every day to come up with my to-do list and keep it organized so that I don't miss steps. And, you know, prior to the RTO, I had somebody that was supporting me directly for a specific amount of time. And it became apparent as we moved back in and things were changing that that would change also. My patience level with my family when I come home is different. I know that everybody was worried when everybody worked from home that you couldn't turn it off when you came out of your office door. That was easy for me, compared to like leaving the facility and getting to my car and coming home and already being stressed about dinner used to be at a certain time and now it's at a different time now. But those are minor inconveniences to me. And what I really want people to know is we had a team of 10. We currently have a team of 7. And everybody said that these positions that we held were important and couldn't be cut. But when you RTO people and you put obstacles in their way, they have to make choices about their mental health and their family's well-being. And none of us are holding that against anybody. But there is a lot of guilt. There's a lot of people feeling like they have failed. And that, to me, is sad. It's not sustainable to have a commute that's inappropriate. We live in Wyoming, and yes, we've made decisions, but we would also have made decisions about a job, not based on a 90-minute commute. So to watch people grapple with that is so hard. We are losing really good people who are really good at their jobs and were really committed to taking care of veterans because of some reason that makes no sense. I'm not back collaborating with everybody. I'm not sitting at a table working with all the people on our team. And that's, I think, been disheartening. And, you know, the barrage of email, like, yes, you have to do your 5 bullet points. No, now you don't have to do your 5 bullet points, but now we want you to tell us what is wrong with the system in one sentence and give us the solution in one sentence. And to have national leadership have that much disrespect about what we do, that I could possibly do anything in a sentence, is mind-boggling and disheartening. And so now we won't be getting RIFT, but I've been pretty clear with everybody that I've talked to that they changed our lives with 2 emails, and they can do it again. I feel myself saying these ridiculous cliches like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Like, I'm not going to be caught off guard like that again. We might have had moments of stress. We might have had, you know, a new fiscal year or, you know, some infrastructure issue that we deal with ourselves in just working for the government. But never have I frequently reminded myself weekly that this is a job, it is not my life. And that makes me sad.
This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman. Last winter, we met Samantha Marks on this show just after the feds laid her off from her job as a probationary physical science technician and volunteer coordinator on the Bridger-Teton National Forest. That meant she lost her federal employee housing, too. She had just started building a straw bale house on a piece of land she bought outside Pinedale.
Yeah, so the goal is we can pick between these two.
And it's like an. She got through the winter couch surfing since rent is expensive there, around $2,000 a month. Then in the spring, she got rehired when courts blocked the mass firings. Now she's back to work and camping out in her barn. Against all odds, she's continued to build a home for herself. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visited her the day she hoisted a large beam on her roof with the help of her friends.
There's going to be a front door here and 2 beautiful windows because this is like the beautiful sunset view over the Wyoming range. Which is kind of why I love the place.
Yeah,
and
this valley is
like
incredible.
Right over there is a giant ranch.
Yes.
You know, in the middle of the night, you hear the cows mooing.
Yeah,
I
love it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that will be the kitchen and a bathroom. And you can kind of tell it's just a little bit boring. I'm back working for the Forest Service, which is really nice. It doesn't feel as secure as it did last year, but more than a couple months ago. Since I was previously fired and rehired, I kind of already came to terms of like, all right, if I have to move on, I'll figure it out. But I can't live every day thinking like, oh, what if I get fired tomorrow? I'm just not gonna be happy or do anything. It's not worth it. When I first left, I was previously in employee housing. With losing the job, I left that. And then once the weather warmed up, I moved to my place here, which has been really nice. I mean, when the weather's nice, it's great.
I don't think the house will be ready for next winter, so I think I'll be having to actually rent a place because it's all winter. Honestly, like, people in town have a lot of dogs, so I've been doing a lot of like dog sitting and house sitting, and between that and, you know, we have access to the aquatic center, which is really nice, so it's not like pure camping. That was one of the main overwhelming things about being fired. I was like, okay, I have, you know, this much in savings, I can find another job, but also having to find a place to live felt so immediate. And I was like, okay, I can figure out one of those at a time, but doing both just was really overwhelming. That's my goal, is to have this place livable before next winter. There's like a very small chance it will happen this winter, but that feels very ambitious, so I don't really want to rely on that. But my line for livable is I need heat and running water. I don't know if I'll have the heating system in, but, you know, maybe I'll have till November to work on it. That's just not determined yet. It's been a hesitant back to work, because a lot of it is like, okay, here's the work I had planned for the summer, but then we lost all funding. And a lot of the work I do doesn't take that much. It's like, I want like $100 for a water sample, but we don't even have that. I mean, almost generically, everyone's working with smaller budget, and like ours, we're like, can we spend anything? We don't currently have any budget officers working for us, so we're like, oh, the trickle down. It's not even like, who can sign off on this if no one's authorized to sign off and no one's getting hired and no one's getting promoted? It's kind of something. But yeah, so a lot of it is like, okay, I want to plan this summer, but like, am I going to get called into something in a month? Or a couple of things, we really rely on volunteers. And I was like, well, I didn't call any volunteers because I wasn't working at the time and I wasn't trusting I could come back. And so now that usually the volunteers are showing up this weekend, it's like, okay, we have some in September, but that's not the same. But also, we were given very, very clear directives on what the priorities are. The priorities are fire. Their priorities are keeping sites open. It's like, oh, look, the campground's open. They must be doing fine. And you're like, yeah, we took 20 people away from their normal jobs just to open this. And we have locked several bathrooms because they are too full and we don't even have the company to come pump them out. And it's just like, hasn't quite hit, because they're like, what do you mean? There's some of them open. And you're like, yeah, but this is not operational in the way you think it is. Yeah. Part of me is like, we're not really gonna not look at water, right? Like, we're definitely gonna start monitoring the air again, right? Like, I don't fully believe that we're just not going to pay attention to these things, but we aren't, and it hasn't changed yet, so we'll see. Yeah.
The next story talks about thoughts of suicide. It lasts about 5 minutes. 20-year-old Richard Midget was fired on Valentine's Day in the first wave of federal layoffs of probationary national park employees. You may remember we spoke to him then. He worked in IT at Yellowstone. A little over a month later, he was rehired and then let go again. The first firing especially took a serious toll on Midget's mental health, and it's shaped his ideas for how he wants to move through the rest of his career.
I wasn't in a very good spot. You can anticipate it as much as you want, but when it actually happens, I mean, it's not like just being laid off. It's through being specifically fired, basically being told that I was a bad worker, and there were no metrics for that. I hadn't even had a performance review, and all my work up to that point had been praised. One of the biggest things they ask when you get a new job or you apply for a new job is, were you fired for any reason previously? And I was just immediately thinking, oh gosh, I'm going to have to put that I was fired from the federal government for being a poor performer, and what that would mean for even getting another job. And so mentally, that took a big toll on me. And I felt like disposable, not wanted, useless, and it's about 10 to 14 minute drive down from Mammoth to Gardner. And the whole time I'm thinking about that, the bridge that's in Gardner, and for the first time, I think in my life, I'd thought about jumping off a bridge. And I had thankfully there's a great community in Gardner and in Mammoth and in Yellowstone where I worked for the past 4 years. And I was able to call a good friend of mine who was a previous supervisor of mine in the park. And she came down to meet me at the gas station right next to the bridge in Gardner and talked me through it. And just talking about it, I mean, helped a lot. At the very moment, for one, it kind of prevented me from ending my life. And it's been a struggle. I stay very strong despite that. It was my kind of biggest point of weakness was that day. And I'm glad I didn't let it get the best of me. It's not just a job, right? It's a career. And a lot of people, myself included, didn't go into work at Park Service or for the federal government in general for money. I wanted to contribute more deeply to the mission and the value that Americans get from the park. Between February 14th and March 20th, I was kind of just involved community-wise in activism, organizing rallies and protests and joining rallies and protests, kind of getting my voice out there, spreading kind of the story of what's going on with the federal government. On the 20th of March, my boss calls me and he informed me that the Department of the Interior was rescinding my termination effective the 25th of March. So I start my job again, but they didn't have any of my credentials ready, like my access card that I needed to do my job in its full capacity. I actually didn't get that until April 8th, just 2 days before I was terminated for the second time. And the reasons are actually quite interesting. I can't say I would ever be fired for something like this again. You have failed to demonstrate fitness for continued employment due to... I stopped by your temporary office to find you sitting in the dark, watching something on your personal cell phone, and eating Fritos. I observed you sitting in your office with the lights off. Therefore, your termination is affected to promote the efficiency of the service. After I was terminated for a second time on April 10th, I had gotten the offer for a private sector employer on the 28th of April and started that position the week of May 19th. I definitely would work for the federal government again. It just has to be the right opportunity and the right time. I'd like to be more of a leader, which is something I hadn't really taken on previously. I want to have an impact on people and not be the kind of leadership that I've seen displayed over the past 7 months. I want to be somebody that people can look up to, talk to, reach out to, and be inspired by.
This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in a crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. A group of non-federal workers has been filling in gaps on the Bridger-Teton after trail crews were laid off there. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Just before the break, we heard several accounts of what it's been like to work for the federal government over the past half year. Now we hear a story about non-federal workers who are stepping in to help make sure trails in the Bridger-Teton National Forest remain accessible and safe. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula Inkney spent a day with the five-person crew to hear how the summer's been going and their concerns for the future.
The members of the Forest Corps, a trail crew assembled by the Friends of the Bridger-Teton to combat staffing shortages due to federal layoffs earlier this year, are fresh off their last hitch. In the backcountry near Tokwoody Pass, you can see their work on the burn scar of the 2024 Pack Trail fire. Over 8 days, they helped clear over 200 fallen trees and place fresh posts and signs marking a stretch of the Continental Divide Trail.
It was good. It was a lot of cutting the first couple of days. You get real dirty working in a burn, a lot of ash all around.
That's 22-year-old Kat Argill, the youngest with a couple of years of trail experience. Soot still covers her hands. Each of the women are familiar with trail work, some working with the Forest Service as recent as last season near Pinedale. They're working with the Bridger-Teton's 6 ranger districts, which now have limited staff.
We're doing our best.
Yeah. Doing what we can every day.
Yeah. A project in every district isn't enough, but yeah, it's a start.
The Forest Service was already understaffed before this year's cuts. The women aren't noticing any huge changes in the Bridger-Teton. They say it's early, and changes will become more noticeable over time as regular maintenance isn't done. 25-year-old Jillian Green.
When you build a turnpike, when you build these trail structures, like, it takes time and energy and hands. And over time, trails are going to fall apart if there's not people there to take care of them.
Scott Kosiba agrees. He leads Friends of Bridger-Teton, the nonprofit that hired the crew.
I think we'll have to do an autopsy at the end of the season to be able to compare, you know, year over year, the impact on programs and on-the-ground work.
On-the-ground work includes responding to wildfire, and though this area has seen a relatively tame fire season so far, drought conditions have primed much of the Rocky Mountain West for wildfire. Missing staff could be felt most in late summer if fires ignite. The investigative journalism outlet ProPublica says nationwide nearly a quarter of firefighting jobs the Forest Service wants are vacant, despite the agency's assertion that they are nearly fully staffed. It's an open question. How many forest employees are enough? Outfitters, hikers, and other recreators near public land will tell you they lend a hand maintaining trails and national forests. But for Kosiba,
I question the long-term viability of that strategy. I am a heavy backcountry user, and I do bring a foldable saw with me when I'm in the backcountry. However, if I'm on a trail that has 40 or 50 down trees, I'm not going to spend 3 days by myself clearing open that trail.
Todd Stiles leads the Jackson Ranger District in the Forest. At a public meeting last month, he advocated for funding Kosiba's organization. He says staff is down 25-30%, excluding fire personnel.
We just really have a handful of folks when you really think about it for the 3.4 million acres that we manage.
Partner organizations like Kosiba's make the BTNF's staff's lives easier.
It's really helping to leverage boots on the ground with people out there.
That's exactly what Argill and her trail crew expect to continue.
We're just going to support those people who have managed to stay in the Forest Service, managed to stay employed, and just don't have the resources to get the work done that they want to go do.
Kosiba's worried about further staffing reductions or funding cuts in the future. The Supreme Court ruled in July that February's federal firings could continue while not deciding their legality. The forest crew members are worried about the same, though right now they're preparing for their next hitch, and other worries are top of mind, like
the mosquitoes.
Dante Filippula Inkney, KHOL News.
A great interviewer or what? 10 out of 10.
In the past two decades, Wyoming and other Mountain West states have seen the steepest drops in fertility rates. Women in Wyoming are having about 25% fewer babies. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach is here to tell us why.
Hey, Camila.
Hey, so first off, what exactly is a fertility rate, and why are we using that word instead of birth rate?
Yeah, so fertility rate is the number of babies being born to 1,000 women of childbearing age, so like 15 to 44. Birth rate, on the other hand, is the number of births divided by the total population, so it's just a lot less specific. Researchers really like to use fertility rates because it shows how many children women of a certain age in a population are having per year.
Got it. And what had the trends been here?
Yeah, so between 2005 and 2023, this 18-year spread, Wyoming saw the 10th biggest drop in fertility rates nationwide. That's from a lending tree analysis of Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data that I verified. So in Wyoming, we saw a drop from 71 babies per 1,000 women in childbearing age to just 55 a year. Plus, across the Mountain West, we saw even bigger drops. Utah was number one nationwide. They went from 93 babies per 1,000 women of childbearing age to 60.
Wow, okay. And why is this happening?
Yeah, so a couple of reasons. So first off, fertility rates were already pretty high in this region, so they just had further to fall during that time period. They had already fallen, say, in the South. This could be partly because we have a lot of religious populations in states like Utah and Idaho, so they could have just been having more babies for longer and kind of finally caught up. Another reason is economic conditions. So rates across the country largely fell after the 2008 recession. Specifically in the West, we've seen rapid population growth in the last couple of years, and so this has brought a slew of affordability issues and housing crises. I talked to University of Utah demographer Emily Harris about how that can impact fertility rates.
A lot of people have in their mind that you buy a house and then you have a kid. With people having to spend more money on buying a house if they're able to, that can impact their decisions on childbearing.
She also said there's been generational shifts about how people think about having children, so they're waiting till later in life. And there's just more women in the labor force choosing to not have children.
Interesting. And so do you know any more about what's specifically happening in Wyoming?
Yeah, Harris actually had a pretty good answer to that more generally.
There's more talk about, you know, the state of the world. There's more talk about environmental concerns. I mean, the economic reality of having a child, it's very expensive. You know, childcare is really expensive.
And in Wyoming specifically, we have a shortage of providers. We also just have a shortage of people to deliver babies. About 1 in 5 counties are maternity care deserts, according to March of Dimes, an organization that tracks this. We also know young people are just leaving for better opportunities. You know, we have a lot of brain drain here. We just don't have that many people to have all the babies. I talked to Wyoming state economist Wenlin Liu about this. He pointed to another factor.
Wyoming's population change is always driven by employment change. And Wyoming's employment trend is always driven by the mining industry.
He says specifically between 2015 and 17, the oil and gas industry was down. So more young people left the state or just didn't come here in the first place.
Got it. And I know Wyoming has a rapidly aging population. Does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, we do. We have a lot of baby boomers here. And Lou actually told me that's because back in the 70s and early 80s, Wyoming had a huge oil boom. So that's when a lot of these people came that are now boomers. But he also said this is changing. Lou said our economy is becoming less dependent on the energy industry. We have more remote workers nowadays after COVID, more people coming here for rural lifestyles and outdoors. He said this could help, but there's still a need to diversify our economy a lot more, which the state of Wyoming is working on. We're investing more in tech industries, nuclear energy, recreation, tourism. But Lou also said if we continue to have low fertility rates, we just need more people to move from other states. But we're competing with all the other states that also need workers. This is a constant moving target, but I'll keep you updated with what I find out next.
Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach, thank you so much for talking to me about fertility rates in the region. Up next on Open Spaces, we'll hear from one Wyomingite who has decided to leave because of recent legislation.
Next time on The Modern West. 5 years ago, a Northern Arapaho judge was sent to prison. Now, she helps keep Wind River residents from going back into custody. It all traces back to a landmark Supreme Court case.
Her story inspires me so much, you know. It makes me want to do better, you know, because it can be done.
I am what I choose to become. It's part 7 of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. Artemis Langford joined the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority during her sophomore year at the University of Wyoming. She was the chapter's first openly transgender sister. Not long after her induction, 6 other members of the chapter launched a federal lawsuit to force Langford's removal, thrusting the transgender student into the national spotlight. The suit was dismissed, then refiled. Langford told Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor she still proudly calls herself a daughter of the state, but now that she's graduated, she has to leave.
Unfortunately, the government doesn't want people like me to live in the state anymore. They don't want transgender people to live freely in this state, and we also don't want economic opportunities in the state. We want to do anything else. Both these factors and also another situation in my life the last 2 years, I think all three of those things, I think it's time for me to go.
Let's dig into that a bit. 3 years ago, as a sophomore, you joined the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority. You were the first openly transgender student inducted into a UW sorority chapter. Before everything that followed, how did it feel to have that distinction?
I was honored to make that distinction because I thought I was representing my sorority. But also, it wasn't wholly unique in that way since it was just, you know, a local thing. I wasn't making any history since trans people across the country had joined Greek life way before I did.
So, in a way, you also just felt like a girl joining a sorority, not necessarily doing something historic.
Yeah, I was just one of the gals.
Did you receive a lot of support from sisters in your sorority when you joined?
Oh, there was so much love and support from members of my chapter. And then I just met wonderful people in Greek life, and that really defied my expectations. But everyone that I met, they were just so kind, especially in the sororities. Like, all the sisters there were just awesome people.
Not everyone was so supportive. A few months later, a cohort of your sisters at Kappa filed a lawsuit trying to kick you out and get a ruling that trans women can't join sororities like yours nationwide. When people you know, sisters in your chapter, are declaring so loudly that they don't view you like you view yourself, does that change how you view yourself?
Yeah, I mean, my entire existence has been politicized. If I listened to every single criticism or every single thing that they wanted, I wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning. There has been a lot of death threats. There's been a lot of hate. And there's been some dark, really dark moments. It's hard not trying to give in to those, because you want to be strong, and you don't want to let those other people see the pain that they've caused. I mean, this lawsuit ruins my life. Because, like, the internet doesn't die. It doesn't forget.
We saw a lot of that heightened scrutiny that you're talking about in the lawsuit. It made a lot of allegations about your behavior, your motivations, your appearance. But those allegations were the thing that really took off. Some of these national outlets painted you as, frankly, a pervert, like someone who faked being a woman to get close to other women in intimate spaces. One exchange between Megyn Kelly and Cassie Craven, one of the lawyers behind the federal lawsuit, demonstrates this.
I think this is a guy who's just getting off on all, living with these beautiful women. That's how it sounds to me.
Be. And I've had no a lot of friends tell me if I knew it was that easy to get into a sorority house, I would have put on a skirt a long time ago. And maybe
the segment we just played aired in May 2023, the same month you were taking finals at UW your sophomore year. How do you manage to study or to take exams or to de-stress when there's this other thing about you playing out in front of a national audience, piercing into your day?
Every day I woke up feeling like, oh, why does my mouth taste bad? And then realizing like, oh, my heart is racing and my mouth tastes like cotton. Oh, I'm having a panic attack. Like I'm waking up with a panic attack. Or like some nights just having total insomnia. I think some of it has to do with just the grace of God helping me get through those finals and being so like I have to pass, like I can't let these guys win by having me fail academically. I just had to push to like succeed. And somehow I managed to get through it.
You've brought your own lawsuit against Cassie Craven and fellow attorney John Knepper, arguing that they used the lawsuit and the media appearances that followed to make money through crowdfunding. Why do this? Why not walk away?
I just need some justice for my name, as my right as an American citizen. Otherwise, how else am I supposed to continue? And so I want some vindication that what happened to me was not acceptable and that what was said about me, you know, was wrong. I don't want anyone else to suffer what I did.
With all of this going on simultaneously, Wyoming was also passing a wave of anti-trans legislation. Today, trans women and girls are banned from women's sports in high school and college. They're prohibited from using women's restrooms. School counselors have to tell parents if their children come out as trans at school. And transgender children and teenagers can no longer access gender-affirming care in the state. You have said you're moving out of state this summer. Do you think it's reasonable for other trans folks to stay and fight? Or do you think, with the way things are, that trans folks should leave?
It's a personal choice that each person has to make for themselves. Because once again, it's all about how much of themselves are they willing to give, constantly trying to advocate to legislators, begging, like, hey, please don't take our rights away. It's a terrible thing when you have to beg for your life over and over and over again. So I don't judge people when they decide to leave, but it's a risk when you do stay because there is a closing window that's beginning to set because these legislators in Cheyenne, they're not going to stop with the bills that were passed earlier this year. And they're going to try even more destructive legislation.
What would it take for you to feel comfortable coming back to Wyoming?
Most importantly to me is just getting rid of these laws. Like just repealing them. Like I'm realistic. I'm not expecting them to pass pro-LGBTQ laws, like rights laws, anytime soon. I'm not asking the world of them, but I also want a place that, like, I don't feel like I'm going to get killed or, like, a healthcare provider is going to refused to treat me in emergency room, so I would just like to see those laws go away.
Looking back on kind of these eventful last few years, if you could go back, would you join a sorority again? Should other transgender students consider that path, or would you tell them to keep their heads down?
I still think that there's immense value in Greek life, especially at the University of Wyoming. Like, I joined for a reason. There's a sisterhood in sororities that you can't really find anywhere else in, like, 21st century young adult life anymore. And so, even all things considered, I don't regret joining, and I would absolutely say people should continue if they want that.
Artemis, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Absolutely, Jeff. It's great to be here.
It's been 140 years since the Rock Springs Massacre. Up next, we follow two descendants of the survivors. This is Open Spaces. If you're in the Sheridan area, we're inviting you to grab a mug of coffee with Wyoming Public Media reporters. Share feedback, give us a news tip, or just get to know us. Plus, every hour we'll be running a raffle for an exclusive Wyoming Public Media news mug. You can't get it anywhere else. Will you be the one to win? Join us from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Monday, August 11 at Java Moon Coffee to find out. Welcome back to Open Spaces. It's been 140 years since a group of Chinese miners were killed in Sweetwater County. Today, Rock Springs is still figuring out how to best recognize this past. Archaeologists and the survivors' families are part of that effort. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry connected with two of the descendants.
In its heyday, the town in the southwestern part of the state was a hub for coal mining. It was also an important stop on the Union Pacific Railroad. Grace and Ricky Leo know it well.
I mean, I was born and raised in Rock Springs. You know, I went to the University of Wyoming, and then I met Grace here.
Other than sharing a hometown, the couple has a lot in common. Both have immigrant parents. Ricky's are from China, and Grace's are from Hong Kong.
We worked at the New Grand Cafe,
a Chinese restaurant Ricky's father ran after serving in World War II. Grace's uncle also ran it, and it's where they first met. Both also just learned about a massacre that roiled their town, and that they have ties to it.
We didn't know that we were related to the people that in the massacre.
The Union Pacific Railroad Company once ran the coal mines in Rock Springs. It first brought in Chinese workers to break a strike in 1875. The federal government then banned Chinese immigration just a few years later. Soon after, labor tensions hit a boiling point when a white mob burned down the Rock Springs Chinatown, killing 28 Chinese.
My great-grandfather's brother, he was the one that survived the massacre, and his son also was a coal miner.
Even though the Leos spent most of their youth in Wyoming, it wasn't until 2019 that they first learned of the massacre.
That was very surprising that I didn't realize there were so many members of my family that were here.
That's also when they learned that nearly half of those killed were Ricky's relatives.
The interesting thing is the Leo clan is not a big clan in China, but, you know, 40% of the Chinese in Rock Springs was from the Leo clan.
Back in southeastern China, one of Ricky's ancestors had recruited extended relatives to come work in the coal mines.
Because back then, China wasn't doing very well. I mean, you know, it was very poor. There was like natural disasters and stuff, floods and stuff.
That was in the 1870s and 1880s.
So they saw an opportunity to come here.
Ricky's ancestors spent their lives going back and forth. They had families in China and work in Wyoming. Union Pacific drove much of the recruiting effort, making Rock Springs the, quote, home of 56 nationalities, a motto still found on welcome signs around town today. This summer, Ricky and Grace returned to their hometown from California, where they now spend most of their time. They had an invite to join an archaeology team from Grinnell College on a dig.
Professor, should I take a soil sample of the sod?
No, you don't need that.
No. Okay. I was going to say,
The dig site was once home to several blocks of a bustling Chinatown made up of shops and houses. The team's dig site mostly takes place in two rectangular holes, about 4 feet deep each, on a grassy lawn that sits between a Catholic church and a playground for a nearby school. The researchers are trying to better understand what life was like in Chinatown before the mob destroyed it. Paul Hornbeek is one of them.
We use shovels, trowels, pickaxes, and so on. But when you come into really delicate stuff like this, you have to just brush it away as gently as you can to try and map it very accurately.
The team's looking for artifacts that can teach them about the daily lives of migrant workers, each who had a foot in two vastly different worlds.
Because the massacre not only involved, you know, the murder of at least 28 Chinese, the mob burned down most of Chinatown. So there's going to be a layer that is very distinctive in the archaeological record. So that is what we're finding. We're finding the burn layer.
That's Laura Ng. She's the professor leading the team of student researchers this summer, and the many descendants who've also come to town to join the dig, including the Leos. This past isn't one that everyone wants to talk about, including some of the other Leo descendants.
Some people want to say, get over it, it happened in the past. Why revisit, you know, something that makes America look bad? And obviously my reason is because we're not learning from those lessons in the past, but also confronting the past is an important part of healing.
Ng's referencing what she describes as a parallel to the present, an economic system she says lures migrants for profits, but doesn't make it easy for them to stay.
We want you for your labor, but we don't want you here.
Today, Rock Springs is experiencing a new chapter in its long history as a draw for immigrants. The town is in Sweetwater County, the first jurisdiction in the state to sign contracts to work on behalf of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
It's hard to see that again and again. It seems like we don't learn from history.
Two local history museums mention the massacre in their exhibits, though the Leo say some of it is incomplete.
There's a video in the Green River History Museum, and it says they don't think there's any Chinese descendants left in Rock Springs, and so we have to let them know, yeah, there's still descendants here.
We're still very active.
In Rock Springs today, there's a statue garden just off the main drag. Life-sized memorials honor fallen soldiers and those who died in the mines. Across town, there's a plaque fixed to a large boulder on a patch of grass between a parking lot and a road. There's a list of the 28 killed Chinese. 13 of them are Leos. In September, Grace and Ricky Leo are returning to host a commemoration for the massacre, where they plan to unveil a new, more visible memorial.
The designer asked if I would be the model for the statue. You know, it's an honor to represent the Leo family.
Ricky hopes this one will be harder to miss. For KHOL News, I'm Jenna McMurtry.
A group of young men just spent a week on the Wind River Reservation for a photo camp with National Geographic. The students camped, fished, and even helped with a bison harvest, all while honing their skills as storytellers and photographers. The group shared their work at a showcase at Central Wyoming College. First, we'll hear from Ronan Donovan, a National Geographic explorer who helped organize the camp with Wind River community members, then from two students.
Men across the United States, and especially on reservations, young men are struggling in disproportionate ways to young women, and the ripple effects throughout communities and societies, I feel like, is profound. If men aren't doing well, then society's not doing well as a whole. We decided to do an all-boys photo camp. We decided to do it on the land in the sense that we were camping out on the northwest part of the reservation at a place called Crow Creek, and we asked what would you like to do, and teepees came up. So we had four teepees that we set up with the group on the first day as kind of a getting us all on the same ground and getting us all acquainted with each other in that process and building home. And then the week progressed surrounding really buffalo and connection to land and place and being in kind of this brotherhood space where there's a vulnerability I think that's allowed when men are in safe masculine spaces with other men. There's comfort and peace and a sense of belonging to being in these quiet natural spaces that a lot of the boys voiced that they hadn't spent time in. They hadn't been camping, many of them. They hadn't been around such quiet in that way. We didn't have cell service, and there were these times where there'd be boys looking at the creek, they'd listen to the wind, they'd listen to the birds, and they would just comment that this was something that they never knew existed.
My name's Corey Budley, and I'm a student photographer for National Geographic. Could I say that? Yeah. And for me personally, the camp was like really cool. It's really cool to meet new people and like experience new things, you know? Like, I've never seen a buffalo get harvested before, so that was pretty crazy to see, you know? Some big things that I learned was learning about portraits, how to take portraits, and messing around with light. I think most of my favorite pictures were like landscape. I took a photograph, it was of like some wheat. It was kind of dark, a little moody. It was like a cloudy sky, and I really liked it. I heard about this photo camp from my Arapaho culture teacher, Mike Redman. He told me about it, and he wanted me to go to it. So I was like, okay, you know, I'll try it out. Getting to meet people and, like, hearing their stories and, like, where they're from and their background. Yeah, it was really cool to hear that.
I'm Jackson Taylor. I'm 18 years old. I just graduated from Moscow High School in Moscow, Idaho. The most special day for sure was the buffalo harvest. That was definitely the most emotional and meaningful day I had during the photo camp. The most profound moment of that day was after the buffalo was killed, seeing the herd gather around it and doing their dance for it and respecting it. And it felt like as many emotions as we had that day, all those buffaloes had the same, if not more intense emotions and feelings, and some of them were mourning, some of them were checking, some of them were fighting with each other, but it just felt, I've never seen an emotional display like it from anything, buffalo or human, but it was deeply beautiful. I learned that I tend to crop the bottom and the top out of every image without fail. So I think when it comes to lessons, that's the biggest is zoom out more. One thing that was discussed a lot is this idea of photography as a weapon. But what I think makes that a pretty profound statement is that it's not a weapon that kills, it's a weapon that reveals truth and knowledge and information. And it's one that gives instead of takes. And I don't think there's another weapon like that on the planet. So I want to use that weapon in my life to give as much as I can and wield the camera responsibly, as we all should, because we all got one on us nowadays. But yeah, just learning about what a powerful and positive tool it is. This is what I want to do. I love photojournalism and I love documentary filmmaking. I've done work in both, and I'd like that to be my professional career.
This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman. And that's it for Open Spaces. Thanks for listening. You can find all our stories on our website and on our social media pages. A big thanks to Hannah Haberman, our on-air producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.